Hello and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in Word Magazine 115, I want to do some follow-ups on some of the topics that were discussed in Word Magazine 114 related to the Textus Receptus and the reading that is found in Revelation chapter 16 and verse 5. In Word Magazine 114, I offered 10 observations on a recent lecture that was presented by apologist James White at Covenant Seminary in Kentucky on text criticism and the TR. And I pointed out that rather than really be an academic lecture, that White ended up presenting what was essentially a review of a Twitter exchange that he had had with someone going under the Twitter handle Textus Receptus, and the conversation had been, again, about an exchange they had related to Revelation 16:5. And indeed, Revelation 16:5 is a very important verse related to one's understanding of the Textus Receptus, because it represents one of the very few places in the printed TR tradition where there is a divided reading, where Baez's 1598 Textus Receptus, which was closely followed by the King James Version, translators apparently reads, which art and wast and shall be, and shalt be, rather. So a threefold description of the Lord, the Kyrios, the one who is, was, and will be. Whereas earlier editions, printed editions of the Textus Receptus, like Erasmus's 1516 TR, read of the Lord, which art and wast and holy, Kai Hasias, rather than Kai Esamenas. And again, this was in Erasmus, and it was also followed by Tyndale in the first English translation of the New Testament, made from a Greek text. And it was followed in the Geneva Bible and other versions, as I pointed out in Word Magazine 114. So, it is a very important verse related to how you understand the Textus Receptus, no doubt. So I put that up last week, and I heard by email and text from several people, and it seems like this was apparently a much discussed topic last week. I'm not saying my Word Magazine necessarily, but in different contexts, Facebook groups, online discussions, the issue of Revelation 16:5 was discussed, and I discovered a couple of things from the feedback that I got. First of all, I found out the identity of the person who was the Twitter disputant with James White, and it's a fellow from Australia named Nick Sayers, and he posted some comments on my blog. And I heard about him from some other folk as well. And then secondly, I discovered that Nick has written an over 80-page booklet that is a response to James White and his views on Revelation 16:5. And he has also posted a couple of YouTube responses. I listened while I was doing some other things this weekend to the first one of these and learned a little bit more about the background, that he had primarily written this booklet to respond to James White's treatment of Revelation 16:5 in his book, The King James Only Controversy. And he had even tried to present this to James White when he was in Australia, and White had sort of dismissed him and not taken the time to read his 80-page response that he had written out, and instead had, again, seized on this Twitter exchange, which makes James White's way of responding to this even stranger, that he would not at least try to read the man's response to him. Anyways, then I learned, thirdly, I have not yet read Nick Sayre's complete 80-page response, but by reading the introduction to it, where he also expresses in the preface to it a shout-out to me, so he's read some of my stuff, although I don't think we agree completely on our views on the Textus Receptus. But he said that one of his key sources for this booklet was an online article that's found on the website kjvtoday.com. And this is not a website I was familiar with, but the article that he pointed to was one titled Beza and Revelation 16:5. And if you print this out, there's a printer-friendly version of it you can find. And I'll put a link to this again when I do a post on jeffriddle.net on Word Magazine 115. You find that this thing is about 16 pages in length. And I also had this same article forwarded to me by several folks who are regular readers of the blog and listeners to the podcast. And so I thought it might be helpful if I would just, first of all, read this shorter article that was found on KJV Today, and offer a little bit of a review of it, since it was influential in Nick Sayre's thinking and what sort of was behind the Twitter exchange. And then possibly later on I might get the chance, which I haven't had yet, to read Nick Sayre's booklet, and then do, if I can, a follow-up review at some point on his article as well, just to understand it a little bit better. And so I did read again this article called Beza and Revelation 16:5 that's found on the site KJV Today. And I thought that in general this is a very well written, it's a thoughtful article. Sometimes people want to put anyone who defends a preference for the King James Version or for the Textus Receptus in a category and say, you know, they are KJV onlyists and they're wild-eyed irrationalists and anti-intellectual and so forth. But if you read this article, you'll find that it's hardly the mad ravings of the straw man KJV onlyists. There were some things about the article that, again, on the other hand, I thought were weak points. I do wish, for example, that the author would put his name on there. I don't get this doing everything, under a pseudonym. You know, go ahead and give us your name. Also, if you're going to write an article like this, at least maybe it's on here and I just couldn't find it, put the date. When was it written? And I thought there were some things about the article since. I mean, if you're going to write a popular article, that's one thing. You don't have to put footnotes and documentation and so forth. But if you're going to write something that's more on academic level, you're going to make points, it'll simply strengthen it if you'll do a competent job at giving documentation and showing, substantiating points that you make and so forth. There were some good things in that area. There is documentation showing for some things, but other points, I think there were some weaknesses. It would make the article stronger if there was just a little better documentation at points. And again, I prefer put your name, put the date on there so we know what we're dealing with. The article in general, I think, makes a generally reasonable and a compelling argument as to why he would accept Beza's reading at Revelation 16:5 as the legitimate text of this verse. And he makes a pretty strong argument as to why Beza's reading at Revelation 16:5 shouldn't simply be discarded, it shouldn't be ridiculed, it shouldn't be rejected offhand. And I think that's one of the things that stings about the way James White operates. If it doesn't fit with what he has a kind of a tunnel vision, if it doesn't fit with what his preconceived notion, then he's not going to give it serious, I think, consideration. It certainly is the Beza reading that was adopted in the King James Version shouldn't be villainized, certainly. On the other hand, again, he makes some compelling arguments. There are some strong arguments. On the other hand, I think there's some weaker arguments, if I could respectfully suggest this. I think there are some weaker arguments within this KJV today.com article, Beza and Revelation 16:5. So, what I thought I would do, again, is just go through this article, and I'm not going to be able to do it exhaustively, but I want to look at what I have written down here as 8 points that I could draw from the article, and some points I'll point out are stronger and some are weaker, but I'm going to give 8 points or 8 observations about this article, Beza and Revelation 16:5. And again, at my blog, jeffriddle.net, I will have my notes from this Word magazine and some links to various things so you can look there. Anyway, so let's start off. So first of all, I thought the article opens with a nice introductory statement. And the introductory statement is this. Since there is no existing manuscript with Beza's reading, critics dismiss Beza's reading as an unwarranted conjectural emendation. However, an in-depth study of the issue will reveal enough evidence to validate Beza's conjectural emendation. So I like the fact that he clearly states at the beginning what his objective is, what his viewpoint is. One of the questions that I raised in the last Word magazine is whether or not Beza's reading at Revelation 16:5 is really what we could technically describe as a conjectural emendation. A conjectural emendation is when a scholar, reader, looks at a text and based on no extant manuscripts, versional evidence, patristic evidence, thinks that he can hypothesize what the original reading was. And you maybe have heard me talk a lot about the fact in the Nessalon 28th edition, there is a conjectural emendation in 2 Peter 3:10, where there's a negative particle, ook, added that doesn't appear in any Greek manuscript. Now, in their defense, there is a versional reading that has this, but there's no Greek manuscript that reads this. One of my questions is it possible that Beza had either Greek manuscript, something that is funny, James White scoffed at that. You think Beza had a Greek manuscript? Well, maybe he did. Possibly he did. They didn't have the modern notation system that's now used at Munster, so they couldn't rattle off, an uncial number or a minuscule number or a lectionary number or whatever else. And so it's possible he could have had that. Or, some versional evidence, something in Old Latin, perhaps he had access to. Maybe this stiffened his resolve to include this reading at Revelation 16:5. I don't know. It is certainly an emendation. It is an emendation to the text. I'm questioning whether it's a conjectural emendation. The author of this article, though, accepts that. He says, okay, I believe that Beza, at this point, made a conjectural emendation. He did not have a Greek manuscript. He didn't have version. He used his own human reasoning. Of course, I'm sure he would believe, and I think he does make reference to the fact that he would believe that God was at work, not in special inspiration, because only the original autographs would have been immediately inspired, but in providential guiding Beza to make this emendation and have it be part of the text. Again, I'm not completely convinced that what Beza did as yet was a pure conjectural emendation. I'll come back to that later. Second point about the article, it provides an English translation of Beza's footnote. And those of you who listen to WM 114 know that I put an image that I had captured of the text of Beza's 1598 Greek Textus Receptus, which had the Greek in one column and then two Latin translations in the center and right column, with the Greek in the left column, and then below it were Beza's notes. And I had put some of that in Latin, but I had not offered a translation. But there is an English translation that is offered of Beza's note within this article. And that, in and of itself, makes this, again, a valuable article. However, this is one of those places where I think on a scholarly level, when I read this, I wanted to know who did the translation. Was this translation done by the author of the article? Well, we don't have his name. Who is he? What are his credentials to make it a Latin translation? Can we trust his translation? And also, in that regard, on a kind of a scholarly level, I would have liked to have seen a transliteration of the original Latin note. And one of the things I pointed out, I think, in the last Word magazine, is that it's kind of hard to make out the Latin printed text there in Beza. It's hard to read it. And I'm sure there are people out there who would have, you know, more ability to do that than I do. But the first thing I want to see is a transliteration of the Latin text. Then I would like to see a translation of the Latin text. And then I would like to see, then there's the analysis of what Beza said. From that note, can we really gather that he made a pure conjectural emendation? Or did he have some manuscript evidence to support his reading that is now lost to us? The article, you know, at least suggests that possibility. It says, although Beza is silent, he could have been influenced in making his change based on a minority Latin textual variant. And then he points out there are two Latin commentaries with readings of Revelation 16:5, which agree with Beza in referring to the future aspect of God. And he then cites two of those two, Beatus of Libana from the 8th century and Haimo Halberstadtensis, I guess it's pronounced. It's easy for you to say, from the 9th century. So it's both a good thing that this English translation is provided, but then I've got some of these questions about the translation and really what it reveals. Third observation, the article also provides reference to two church fathers who made use of the Greek term ha esamenas, which is what appears in Beza and is assumed underlying the translation of the King James Version. But he finds and points to two church fathers who use this term, the one who will be, in reference to God. And the two references that he cites, the first is from Clement of Alexandria, who uses this term in the 3rd century, and he cites the specific work, the Stromata, and from, I guess, Book 5, Chapter 6, I'm assuming. And then he also cites it from Gregory of Nyssa in the 4th century. And here he cites the work on the baptism of Christ, but he doesn't give us a book number and a chapter number. And so that's another place where, just to be picky on a scholarly level, I want to see the specifics. Where exactly is this cited? And I think he says he found it on the Christian Classics Ethereal Library, but just give it the proper scholarly notation. Now, you might remember that James White sort of pilloried Nick Sayers for mentioning this, and Nick had apparently picked this up from this article from this unnamed author, and White is saying, this is ridiculous. Well, obviously, I agree with the author of this article. This is not a red herring. What he's establishing is that this term, ha esamenas, the one who will be, was a standard early Christian way of referring to God. And it's also possible that this language could have been picked up from Revelation 16:5. It could be a literary allusion to Revelation 16:5. It's kind of like when you read John Bunyan. It was said of Bunyan, if you prick him anywhere, his blood will be bibline. If you read Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, it's hard to tell when he's quoting something from the Bible and when he's not, because his language is so influenced by biblical language. And here, this could be a place where these church fathers are simply reflecting the language of Revelation 16:5. So to say this is a red herring, that it's unimportant, to dismiss it without any consideration, as James White does, again, is unjustified. Fourth of 8 points about this article in review. The article rightly stresses the fact that the text of Revelation was perhaps the most corrupted text that is found in the New Testament. That during the transmission process of Revelation, because it was so challenged, because its place in the canon was challenged, and I'm not saying in any way, shape, or form that the church decided what were the books of the canon. I much rather prefer the language of they recognized it, but there was a struggle for the recognition of the canonicity of Revelation. It's reflected if you look at Eusebius in his church history. He acknowledges this, that Revelation was accepted by some. It was contested by others. It was part of the anti-legomena, the books spoken against. And so because of that, its textual transmission reflects difficulties, it reflects challenges, it reflects disputes. And for that reason, probably in the book of Revelation, we'll come back to this later, there are maybe more disputes over text than any other place in the New Testament. And for that reason, just shows more light on why there might have been textual issues at a place like Revelation 16:5 and in other places. At this point within the article, the author says, conjectural emendations are justified if we know that the text we are dealing with has a history of extensive and early corruption. The book of Revelation is such a text. And then he says, we trust that God was able to preserve the true reading of Revelation 16:5 until the advent of the printing press during the Reformation. So, again, he's assuming that Beza made a pure conjectural emendation. And, again, I'm questioning whether it was a pure conjectural emendation. And the other point I would say is we also don't know with regard to the King James Version whether the translators of Revelation were dependent for their reading. They adapt in Revelation 16:5, were they dependent upon Beza, or did they have other evidence, other manuscript evidence? And so, again, I stressed this last time, something that's not often acknowledged. There's simply places where we just don't have sufficient evidence to be able to draw the firmest conclusions about what happened in the textual transmission process, and also what was before the various editors who printed the editions of the TR that were put out in the Reformation period, or what texts were used by the early vernacular translators of the Bible That's not just the King James Version, but all the early English and other popular language translations. We don't always know what manuscripts they were dependent upon. A fifth point or observation. I think a very good point was made within the article related to the possibility of a scribal error at Revelation 15:4, in which the word holy, hasios, is omitted. And the author of the article says, if there is evidence of a scribal error involving hasios at Revelation 15:4, it seems reasonable to suspect a scribal error involving the same word just one chapter later at Revelation 16:5. And again, this is related to the reading in P47, that in P47, Papyrus 47, which is the only early papyrus that has an extensive record of the text of Revelation and includes Revelation 16:5, at Revelation 15:4, it omits the word hasios, holy, and then the word appears in Revelation 16:5, so it just shows that there's some scribal confusion, perhaps, and I think he makes a good point there. Sixth observation or point. I think there's another excellent observation that is made by the author relating to Revelation 11:17. Revelation 11:17 in the King James Version reads, saying, we give thee thanks, O Lord God Almighty, which art and wast and art to come, because thou hast taken to thee thy great power and hast reigned. And he points out that here we have God identified as Lord God, Kurios Theos, or Kurios Pantokrator, I think it is, Lord God Almighty, which art and wast and art to come. And there is the threefold description of God, the one who is, the one who was, and the one who is to come. And since I stumbled on that, I'm going to look it up in my Greek text real quickly just to make sure that I got that correct. So it's Revelation 11:17. Yeah, it's actually Kurie, it's the vocative of Kurios, Ha Theos, Ha Pantokrator, Lord God Almighty, Ha Hon, who is, Kai Ha Ein, and who was, Kai Ha Erkamenos, and who is coming, or who will be. What's interesting is that this is another place where there's a threefold description of God, but in the majority text, that last part, the one who is coming or the one who will be, is absent in the majority text, and it's also absent in the modern text. So it's another place where the Textus Receptus departs from the reading that is found in the majority text or Byzantine text and also in the modern critical text. So, again, I think it's a good observation. In this case, in Revelation 11:17, there are extant Greek manuscripts, although they are in the minority, that support the TR reading. We wish we had that at Revelation 16:5, but we don't. We don't have the supporting Greek manuscripts. Perhaps they will be discovered in the future. Who knows? Seventh observation. I think the article rightly points out the paucity of extant early manuscript evidence for Revelation. Again, this is very, very important. It states that there are only four manuscripts of Revelation 16:4 from before the 10th century, and that P47 is the only papyrus manuscript to include Revelation 16:5. This is another place in the article where the scholar in me would like to see, some documentation of this, although I think it's probably right. You may remember in Word Magazine 114, I made a similar point, but I made sure I cited an authoritative source, and I cited the work of Tobias Niklas in his article that he contributed to the book, The Early Texts of the New Testament, published by Oxford. And I think it's better for us, by the way, if we can always cite the best secular academic research, the best secular academic publishing houses, so they know this is not a KJV-only publisher. And so this is Tobias Niklas, The Early Texts of Revelation, and The Early Texts of the New Testament, edited by Charles Hill and Michael Kruger. It's found on pages 225 to 238. But anyways, I made the similar point, and Niklas points out, hey, the text of Revelation, the early text of Revelation, is scanty. There's not much there. And I think the author of this article makes that same point. I just wish, again, some documentation. I also think the article errs in relationship to this. He has a discussion he sort of sets up a degenerating chain. He says in P47, it says Kai Hasios, and holy. Then in Sinaiticus, which would be the 4th century or so, it says Ha Hasios, the Holy One. And then in Codex Alexandrinus, which is dated 5th century, it says just simply Hasios. So the article Ha has dropped out. And he suggests a sort of a chain from Kai Hasios in P47 to Ha Hasios to simply Hasios. And I think that is a little bit confusing, and I think people who have a scholarly knowledge would see that as speculative and assuming a direct connection between these three manuscripts, between P47, Sinaiticus, and Alexandrinus, which I think is unproven. And I think the differences between those three texts could have evolved independently. So just on a scholarly level, I think this idea of a chain, direct chain from P47 to Sinaiticus to Alexandrinus would be a point not well taken. Eighth and final observation. The article provides four theories for how Revelation 16:5 might have become corrupted. And the four theories are: Theory 1, John wrote Ha Esamenos in a nomen sacrum form, in a sacred name form. And nomen sacrum is the singular for the better known term, the nomina sacra, the sacred names or sacred terms. And what this means is that within Greek manuscripts, there were abbreviations used not just for words that were much repeated, but also for words that have a sacred content, like the word kurios. Rather than writing each of the Greek letters out, they would abbreviate it by writing the initial kappa and then the final sigma, and then writing a solid line over the top of them. And so instead of writing out kurios, they would just put this nomen sacrum. And words like Jesus and God were often abbreviated in this manner. So that's his first theory, that John, the original author of the book of Revelation, used a nomen sacrum in Revelation 16:5, and he wrote essentially this as a way to say the God who is, who was, and who will be. And then this was later, that nomen sacrum was wrongly interpreted to be Hasios. The second theory he puts forward is that bad conditions gave rise to corruption. Third theory, a scribe harmonized Revelation 16:5 with Revelation 11:17, something we briefly discussed earlier. And his fourth theory is that a Hebraist imposed Hebraic style onto the text. And this is the idea that the original was the God who is, was, and will be. And because the Hebrew doesn't have a future participle, some Jewish scribe thought that who is and who was sufficient. And that's how the text got mutilated from the original. Of these four theories, I find theory two and theory three to be somewhat credible, but I think theories one and four are suspect. Let's talk about theory one in particular. Theory one is the idea that the Apostle John wrote Ha Esamenas, and actually not just Ha Esamenas, but well, I guess his idea is that Ha Esamenas, the Holy One, was written in this sacred name form. So it was written as an Omicron, an Epsilon, and then as a Sigma. So it would look like kind of like an OEC. And somehow this was taken to be Hasias rather than Ha Esamenas. And so why do I discount this as a theory? First of all, it seems to me to be speculative. It seems like another idea he presents, not just that this could be, there could have been a nomina sacris for the triad as well. But I just see this as being speculative. Even as you're reading through the article, you can pay attention. It's always a warning bell for me. When I read Metzger's commentary, the same warning bell goes off. Whenever an author begins to use may, perhaps, might, it's more speculative. It's more conjecture. And he's getting into an area where he doesn't have firm and direct evidence to support his point. I'll put a link to James Snapp's little online article on the Nomina Sacra, where he shows you how the more common ones, again, like Kurios, Lord, Theos, God, Christos, are written. And the thing is that Ha Esamenas is not a regular nomen sacrum that's found in the textual transmission tradition. Again, he tries to make the point that it could possibly be there in Codex Sinaiticus in the scrunched up end of a line. I'm not convinced by that. He also points out in P47 there's an odd abbreviation of the word anthropon, a man of man. Again, I'm not convinced of that, and so I think it's just too speculative. And the same thing for theory four, the speculation about a Jewish reader who would have taken the future participle as being unnecessary, and this also seems to me to be strained and speculative. So it's kind of hard to do a review like this with these specifics, and I hope that these eight observations about the article haven't been too confusing. Anyways, so my final conclusion on the article is it's a generally well-written article, makes some really good points. I learned a lot from it. I'm thankful for it. There were a few things on a scholarly level that I think there are places that could be improved, and I'm not convinced by all the arguments that are put forward within it. But anyways, I wanted to look at that article because it obviously had influenced Nick Sayers, and then that had influenced the Twitter exchange he had with James White, and obviously other people have read the article and have profited from it. So I wanted to close, having done this review, with offering just a few more final thoughts. And again, these are things I'm continuing to think about when I have the time and opportunity to do so. And so I wanted to offer three kind of summary thoughts about this whole issue of the Textus Receptus and Revelation 16:5 and Beza and the King James Version and conjectural emendations and so forth. So the first observation will relate to Revelation 16:5, the Textus Receptus, and the King James Version. Interpretation of Revelation 16:5 raises the question of what the standard text of the Textus Receptus should be. And I've said several times, I think we need a critical edition of the Textus Receptus. But if we did that, what would we include there at Revelation 16:5? And again, I realize when we talk about this, there are going to be some modern critical text advocates who are going to be jumping up and down with joy saying, oh great, they don't know what the TR is. Again, the fact that we can have an open discussion of this does not downgrade or invalidate a TR position. I'll take the TR with a couple of questions about differences in the printed text over the almost unending questions that are raised about the text that are represented by the text that is produced by the modern critical method. But anyways, I think there is room in the TR camp for those who would follow the Erasmus Tyndale reading, if we could call it that, and also for those who follow the Beza KJV reading here, if we could call it that. And if I were to list what I think are the best reasons that one might accept the Beza KJV reading at Revelation 16:5, so that you would accept the reading that says who is, who was, and who will be. What are the best reasons? And I've jotted down here six, I think, of the best reasons why you might accept this. First of all, you might accept it because you recognize that the text of Revelation was corrupted in its early transmission, and even those who embrace the modern critical reconstructionist method acknowledge that Revelation is one of the most difficult texts to reconstruct. And so one of the strongest arguments in favor of accepting Beza KJV here is you recognize, first of all, that the text of Revelation is difficult. Second, argument in favor of accepting the Beza KJV reading at Revelation 16:5 is that P47, the earliest text, earliest witness to Revelation 16:5, at least provides evidence for the conjunction chi in the earliest extant manuscript of Revelation 16:5. It has chi ha hasias, but it has the conjunction there, and so which is not in the modern critical text or in the majority text. But it has that conjunction. And so we're talking now just about one word. We're talking about hasias or esamenas. It has chi. Third argument of these six arguments. Internal evidence within Revelation argues for a threefold description of God as present, past, and future, as typical of the descriptions of God within the book of Revelation. So at Revelation 1:4, at Revelation 1:8, at Revelation 4:8, and in the TR text of Revelation 11:17, God is described as the one who is, was, and the one who is coming, or the one who will be. So there is internal evidence, and Revelation 16:5, although we'll talk about it in just a minute, doesn't follow by having ha erkamenos, but it has ha esamenos, but at least follows sort of the conceptual construal of how God should be described as present, past, and future. Fourth argument of the best arguments, I think, in favor of the Beza TR reading at Revelation 16:5 would be that the fact that the participle ha esamenas argues for its originality because it is not ha erkamenas. If it were simply a pure conjecture by Beza, then why would he not have just chosen the same participle from erkamai that's found at Revelation 1:4, that's found at Revelation 1:8, that's found at Revelation 4:8, that's found in the TR of Revelation 11:17. But instead of just plugging in ha ekamenas, he has the reading ha esamenas. And if it were just a pure conjecture, and it was purely added in order to harmonize with the other places where there is this triadic description of God as the one who is, was, and will be, why didn't he just follow the text as it's found elsewhere? The fact that it is a future participle, ha esamenas, would argue in my mind that it was not a conjecture, and he did so because he was following a text that he had found, or a version that he had found. Fifth observation. We need to acknowledge that we do not completely understand all the evidence and reasoning of Beza and the KJV translators in choosing this reading, but we might reasonably assume that they had compelling reasons to adopt it, especially since it went against the tide of respected earlier editions of the TR, and especially English translations of it. So the KJV translators in particular would go against the reading in Tyndale, I think argues that they had some compelling reason to do so. A sixth argument, as I see the best arguments for adopting the Beza KJV reading at Revelation 16:5, would be simply to acknowledge that one can see the inclusion of this reading in the KJV as of providential importance without arguing for the KJV as a product of special revelation. And so, you know, again, I'm taking a confessional text approach, following the Westminster Confession of Faith and the Second London Confession of Faith, chapter 1, paragraph 8, that says that the Bible was inspired, immediately inspired in the original languages and not in the versions that were translated from those immediately inspired original languages. So I don't want to say that KJV was a special revelation, but I can acknowledge the providential importance of the fact that it appears in the King James Version, which becomes the dominant translation of the Bible in the English-speaking world. And I think it would be foolish not to acknowledge the influence of the English-speaking Protestants and their influence in the development of the Protestant movement. And is it just by accident that this ends up being the reading in the dominant English translation in the Anglo-Saxon world? So second of my three ruminations about this text is that the most difficult to defend TR readings is related to the most difficult to defend TR readings and the propriety of conjectures. So I've been turning this over in my mind and thinking about this, and here are some thoughts. So I think that in general, we would obviously prefer to have Textus Receptus readings that are supported by at least some extant Greek New Testament manuscripts. That is optimal. Even if it's only a few manuscripts, even if they only represent a minority of the extant Greek manuscripts, even if they are late manuscripts. Let's talk about the Koma Yohaneum. Yes, we only have a few. Yes, they're late. Yes, some of them are in the margins. But we do have Greek manuscript evidence. So we would wish we would have that for every single TR reading that we would adopt. If we don't have a Greek manuscript, we would like to have it, or if we only have a few and they're later, we would like to have versional evidence. We'd like to have it in Old Latin, Coptic, even the Latin Vulgate. And we would also like to have patristic evidence. I think it has a lot of weight when you look at the ending of Mark, for example, and you can say that it's there in some of the early church fathers. And so, we would like to have that. And thankfully, with regard to the TR, we usually have this in the overwhelming number of instances. We have some Greek manuscript support. Often we have excellent Greek manuscript support. We have the early papyri and uncials that support our readings. Even in the difficult ones, we have some Greek manuscript evidence support. So that's optimal. That's what we want. However, we should also recognize that the New Testament books, which were acknowledged the latest in the canonical recognition process, will usually provide the least sufficient and reliable extant evidence. Let me unpack that again. We should recognize that the New Testament books, which were acknowledged the latest in the canonical recognition process, will provide the least sufficient and reliable extant evidence. Again, when it comes to canon, this is another place where text criticism is related to canon. Again, I don't think that the church recognized the books. They didn't vote on them. But the books have their own self-authenticating authority because they are in the inspired Word of God. And it's a matter of Christians recognizing that they are part of the canon of the New Testament. But we should acknowledge that historically, there were some books that were acknowledged, recognized later in the process than others. Our most difficult text to defend with regard to the TR will most generally not be texts that are found in the Gospels or in the Pauline epistles. Usually we will have plenty of Greek manuscript evidence, versional patristic evidence to support TR readings in the Gospels and the Pauline epistles. But our most difficult to defend texts are going to come in the books that were acknowledged later in the canonical recognition process, which means our most difficult to defend texts are going to be in the book of Acts, in the Catholic epistles, and in the book of Revelation. Now, this admission, this recognition, this observation goes against a standard conservative evangelical apologetic, which has typically stressed the great number of existing New Testament manuscripts, whatever their date, whatever their content, whatever their condition. If you go back and read apologetic books from 30 years ago, sort of on the level of Josh McDowell or other people of that ilk, all the way up to the present time, you still will hear evangelicals sort of parroting this. They'll say the New Testament is, we have more manuscripts in the New Testament than any other book of antiquity. And often you'll hear evangelical presentations where they'll say we have 5,000 Greek manuscripts, but we have only a handful of manuscripts from Caesar's Gallic Wars or something like that. And there's part of that that is true, that there are more Greek manuscripts. But what the layman hears that and he thinks we've got 5,000 extant total copies of the New Testament. And that's not true. When we talk about over 5,000 Greek manuscripts, we know that often that includes papyri that have a verse, a half verse, a few words, or, one chapter, or sometimes one book or something like that. So the evidence, we must admit, that the number of manuscripts that survive for many books, particularly those that were recognized late in the process, Acts, the Catholic Epistles, and Revelation, we do not have a lot of early manuscript evidence that survived from that period. And it's important, it's kind of counterintuitive for defenders of the Textus Receptus to overturn this view that was so popularly put forward by evangelicals in apologetics to stress how many manuscripts we have. We need to acknowledge that no, in fact, in many cases, we don't have a lot of, God has not allowed many manuscripts of many of these books to be preserved, but he's preserved his word in another way. That's going to be our point. He's preserved his word during the time of the advent of the revolution of the printing press. He worked providentially to preserve his word in that time and period and by those means. And with regard to acknowledging the reality in a place like Revelation of how the transmitted text has been damaged and how there are disputes about it, then this raises the whole question, as the author of the article that we reviewed today does, about the propriety of conjectures, making conjectures, even if they're very small ones, as at Revelation 16:5 potentially. Are conjectures justified? And as the article points out, conjectures are not a problem for those who embrace the modern critical text and the modern critical method. Bruce Metzger, for example, in the text of the New Testament, talks about, you know, when it's right to use a conjecture. It's not a problem for the modern editors of the Nestle-Lund 28th edition. It's not a problem for those who use the coherence-based genealogical method. We've talked about 2 Peter 3:10. It is affirmed by those who did what we could call modern text criticism, those who worked in the 19th century and the 20th century, people like Metzger. It's approved by those who are doing text criticism in the 21st century, those who are using the coherence-based genealogical method. And if that's the case, then why all the howling and hooping if Beza made a conjectural emendation relating to essentially one or two words in Revelation 16:5. Again, I'm not yet convinced that it was a pure conjectural emendation, but why all the howling? And as I was reflecting on that a little bit more, I was thinking about in the modern historical critical method, the development of the theory of there being a sayings document called Q. If you've ever taken an academic course, Introduction to the New Testament, Survey of the New Testament, and you get to the Gospels, you'll be introduced to what is called the synoptic problem. Why is it that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are so similar to each other and John is significantly different? And back in the 19th century, primarily in Germany, and then it spread over to England, scholars developed what was called the two-source hypothesis, and then it was expanded by B.H. Streeter to be called the four-source hypothesis. But it's the idea that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the synoptic gospels, are similar to each other because they have a literary relationship. And the theory was put forward by some German scholars in the 19th century that Mark was the first gospel written, so-called Markan priority, and they suggested that there was a saying source that was called Q, from the German word Quelle, meaning source. And so this was a hypothetical, reconstructed saying source called Q. And this view was widely embraced by many evangelical scholars. It still is embraced by evangelical scholars, people teaching at evangelical institutions. And I recently read a book I read last year that came out from Baker Academic called The Synoptic Gospel, Four Views. And one of the views that was there is one by Craig Evans, who teaches at Houston Baptist University. And he argued for the two-source theory. He argued for mark and priority and the existence of Q, a hypothetical saying source. Do we have Q? No, Q is a conjecture. I find it ironic that Evans and other evangelicals can embrace the existence of Q, an entire hypothetical book that rests on no manuscript evidence, no external support, no one has ever discovered Q, that can happen and no one raises an eyebrow, while Baez's supposed conjecture of perhaps a few words in Revelation 16:5 can be pilloried as outrageous and absurd. And again, this just seems to me to be very inconsistent. I noted last time I was kind of puzzled by James White's stated rejection of any conjectural emendations when he gave the talk that was reviewed in Word Magazine 114. And when I read that, I thought, well, does this mean he rejects Metzger now? Does this mean he rejects the coherence-based genealogical method? Does this mean he rejects the text of Nesselon 28, of the forthcoming Nesselon 29, which will also use the coherence-based genealogical method, of other conjectures that might appear in the modern critical text? What is his position exactly? But that'll be maybe for us to hear later from him. Third observation, reflection, relates to the whole issue of method. I think that the historical study of the text of the Bible, what we typically call textual criticism, is a vital discipline. It's one from which those of us who support the text of Receptus have nothing to fear. I also think that defenders of the text of Receptus can and should be able to make use of all the historical evidence that is uncovered by people who do study of the ancient text of the Bible and its transmission. There's nothing wrong with that discipline, and it's good for us to be aware of it. However, I think we need to be careful not to fall into the trap of using the modern reconstructionist method alone to defend the TR. And this is one of the biggest problems I perceive with this article and the approach of many others who are defending the TR, and I could even be critical of myself sometimes with this too. We should not be falling in the trap of being dependent upon the very method that we are criticizing, the reconstructionist method, to support our point. We are not dependent upon a reconstructionist method. We're dependent upon a confessional method. We believe in the providential preservation of the Word. We cannot necessarily think that we can reconstruct the text in the TR, that we can reconstruct Revelation 16:5. If you try to fight the modern Methodists, if I can use that term, I don't mean United Methodists, but Methodists with a small m, those who use the historical critical method. If we try to fight the modern Methodists only with their method, in their eyes, we will always come up short. I had mentioned before that Peter Gurry had put my recent review of the Tyndale House Greek New Testament up on the Evangelical Text Criticism blog, and there were 20 or so comments on it. And one of the comments that was put up came from Maurice Robinson, who is a defender of the majority text, Byzantine text, and has in 2005 has a published edition of that text that's often referred to. And part of the conversation that was going on in the comments was about, exactly what this Riddle Guy's position is. You know, does he hold to the Textus Receptus? How could anyone possibly hold to the Textus Receptus? And I really thought Maurice Robinson had an interesting post related to that discussion. He said this. He said, in terms of attempting to establish the original text or the Ausgangs text, if one is so inclined, a TR priority position indeed is illogical, as Mr. Spock would say. However, within the confessional bibliology or ecclesiastical text framework, holding such a position actually appears quite reasonable to its practitioners, much in the same way that the Greek Orthodox Church remains quite content to use a form of the 1904-1912 Antoniades text for all their practical purposes, even though from a more scientific text critical standpoint, including my own, their position is equally defective. And I thought, man, Maurice Robinson gets it. The confessional text position is not about attempting to reconstruct the TR. It's not about attempting to convince people that we can reconstruct it by proving that there was a nomen sacrum here or there. It's about saying we think that God has preserved his word in the printed text that emerged in the Reformation period and that became the basis for all the Protestant translations. And we believe that it is appropriate for the church, it is appropriate for the people of God to look to this text and for it to be a stable, steady, unchanging text that will be the basis of our preaching and teaching and our popular translations, rather than to depend upon an uncertain, ever-evolving, ever-emerging modern critical text that is never stable and does not have its basis in the people of God. So I think he got it, quite right in that comment. Well, I hope that this Word Magazine hasn't been too discombobulated. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of my theologizing, philosophizing on this very important topic. I feel like I'm still a student of it. I'm still learning things. I'm still turning things over. And it's good to have some fellow travelers and some fellow learners with whom we can dialogue and discuss these things. Hope you've enjoyed this Word Magazine, and I'll look forward to speaking to you next time. Till then, take care and God bless.